It's The Wonky Show. We're talking a new ministerial directive, medical students, strikes, OFS, culture wars and more. It's all coming up.
When we talk about universities, it's really important that we actually talk about the fact that these are communities. And why I keep going on about that is that, you know, you have HR professionals, you have finance, you have accountants, you have technicians, you have cleaning staff and porterers, the full range of people in society.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to splash around in the deep end of HE policy, it's three absolute giants of the sector this morning. And on the South Coast, it's former Vice-Chancellor and Director of Leadership Development at Minerva, Mary Stewart. Mary, your hire to the week, please.
Actually, Mark, can I have two? I'm just really greedy that way. So the first one is I have to say this because, you know, I'm doing this Emerging Leaders course for middle managers in higher education. And we had a session yesterday, which Sunday Blake joined us for. And it was just fabulous. Everyone was blown away with what she talked about in terms of the student belonging work that Wonky had done. And it's really great because this group of people don't know much about HE policy. So it's great to bring that into a program like that. So that's my one. And my other is it's been beautiful weather down here, absolutely gorgeous, blue skies, cold, but just the reflection on the sea and going for walks at lunchtime, which I can now do, is too gorgeous for words.
In Hertfordshire is Andy Westwood, Professor of Government Practice at the University of Manchester and other things. Andy, your hire of the week.
Well, I've desperately tried to think of one, but I haven't got any. It's cold, I'm freezing. And everything in HE policy is making me really, really grumpy. So watch out.
And in the Wonky studio, it's Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Debbie, your hard of the week.
Well, I'm just really happy to be back at Wonky and back picking up the threads of higher education policy that have happened. Well, for anyone who's not aware, for the last 7 months, I've been on maternity leave after having a baby. But the flip side of that is that I'm not getting a lot of sleep still right now. So the highlight of my week is the rather excellent coffee that I just consumed to prepare me for my re-entry into the world of podcasting.
Now, we start the week with the letter from the Minister for Higher Education and a bunch of other things besides. Debbie, talk us through what Robert Halfen has to say.
So, yep, yesterday Robert Halfen wrote to vice chancellors, and this is not the sort of ministerial letter that everybody needs to kind of get very worked up about. I've written it up on Wonk Corner. It's actually the occasion for it seems to have been that there's a bit of concern about what's going to happen with the admissions cycle this year, and Halfen has flagged a few issues which we'll talk about, and has also taken the opportunity to reiterate some of his key priorities for universities. So the worry, I think, is that, you know, after 2 years of admissions chaos, with exams being cancelled because of the COVID pandemic, Ofqual in England is planning to return to the kind of, you know, business as usual this year. And the consequence of that is that once again, for universities, it will be rather hard to predict the numbers of A stars and A's and all that sort of thing. So the kind of the pattern of applicants could look different again. And Halfen, presumably ahead of the January deadline, wants to kind of warn vice chancellors and by proxy there, you know, deans of admissions, that it's going to be another tricky year, and to think about things like admissions to medical schools, for example, because it was enormously oversubscribed last year. And he's also taken the opportunity to do two things. One is to remind universities that now that T levels are up and running, that those students who are entering university from a T level will need a bit of clarity about what the entry requirements are and what that progression route looks like. So he's urging vice chancellors to arrange for there to be a statement on university websites. And actually, I think that sort of seems like a pretty reasonable request in the round. The other thing that he's doing, which is a bit of a kind of personal hobby horse of his, is urging particularly the most prestigious universities, or the more, you know, in our kind of nomenclature, the most selective, to explore delivering more degree apprenticeships. And his rationale for this is about social justice and the kind of broadening the kind of range of options available, and also about skills for jobs, which he's very strong on as well. Nothing to set the world on fire, and actually mostly quite sensible stuff. And I'm kind of inclined to see this as as quite a useful kind of indicator of perhaps a more constructive relationship going forward. And I've written on the site about that this morning. But others may have different views, of course.
Mary, it must be a relief not to have to open your inbox to find letters from ministers these days.
It became quite a frequent thing, and often one's heart sank, actually. But no, this doesn't sound, it sounds, as Debbie was saying, I think a bit like a bit of a reset. It's largely sensible. It's not, uninformed. It is, of course, incredibly late to be talking about admissions when, certainly for the sort of institutions that, the government is often interested in, they will not be making many offers post the deadline next week. So that is the only thing that I kind of constantly feel about government, is if they want to remind people of things like this, they really ought to do it a lot earlier. But of course, in this case, because we kind of keep changing ministers and all the rest of it, it probably wasn't that possible. But Robert Holfman is a really rather sensible individual, and I think most of us have kind of welcomed him coming into post, actually.
He's also signalled that he's willing to kind of normalise relationships with NUS as well after
which is kind of, is good yeah. news in their response to the report. We just have to see that followed through and dealt with, really. But it is good news, having a break between NUS and any organization, but obviously particularly government, is not helpful in that sense.
I think we have a clip of that. Here it is.
Speaker, when I met with Jewish students studying in universities in my constituency, I was appalled to learn of the anti-Semitism that they have to suffer on a daily basis often, and made worse by the recent report into the NUS, the National Union of Students, handling and challenging of anti-Semitism. In the month where we mark Holocaust Memorial Day, I would be interested to hear the Minister's assessment of that NUS report.
I thank my right honourable friend for her question. I've been shocked and sobered by reading this report, that NUS was in essence a hostile place for Jewish students. That's not acceptable. NUS, National Union Student, the main body for students, should be a place that isn't just safe, but a place that is welcoming for Jewish students as well. And the proof of the pudding of this report will be in the eating. I expect to see the changes and the recommendations implemented in full. And once that has occurred, then I will re-engage with the National Union of Students.
Andy, this question of medical students is a real one, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of press for the last couple of weeks about the need for new places, and Labour starting to talk a lot more about it. This is kind of one of the new thought lines, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many new thought lines. I mean, in the letter, set against the kind of standards of recent letters, it's okay, but the sort of new bits and interesting bits are sort of few and far between. If you ever rocked up to listen to Halfen at party conference, as I have on a number of occasions, I've sat on a few panels with him. He talks about degree apprenticeships and T-levels all the time. I think he still completely misunderstands both in relation to higher education, but that's a slightly different story. But the medical kind of school places obviously has, as you say, become a big issue, because of the kind of state of the NHS, brackets terrible, and B, because solutions are beginning to kind of knock around, not just from Wes Streeting and Labour, but also from the NHS itself, saying we need more doctors and nurses to be trained in the UK. The problem is, of course, it's very hard to do that. I mean, creating the capacity in a system where the NHS is pressurised is very tough, and summoning them up from a sector that is facing its own financial challenges. And let's not forget, running a medical school is about the most expensive thing you can do in higher education, and usually depends, even with higher levels of government funding, usually depends on cross-subsidy from elsewhere in the institution. And so, you know, what you've essentially got here is a minister asking for one broken system to support another broken system and hope it'll all be okay in the wash-up. And it's not going to be.
It is noticeable, yeah, that, you know, the kind of, there's always this thing about kind of sort of saying you don't want ministers. It's quite nice, isn't it, to see a minister that's not trying to interfere. You know, he's not saying, you know, I've been concerned about curriculum, or actually, do you know what? I've been thinking we need to have PQA and admissions. You know, he's not, in some ways that's quite helpful. On the other hand, sort of saying, I've noticed that this is going to be a problem. Good luck with that when it comes to, you know, sorting out admissions. You know, you don't want them to interfere, but then you also want a bit more constructive, support with trying to figure out the implications as well. And it's a hard needle to thread.
It does signal, though, doesn't it, kind of policy in the freezer by and large on these big questions. It doesn't seem to me to be the harbinger of kind of a big new ministerial agenda on any of these items.
No,
soon.
But that's because there's a lot of other things that haven't fully been implemented yet. I mean, you know, of course it's great that he's not coming in with hundreds of ideas, but you know, as Andy says, he has particular things that he's absolutely passionate about, and that's what he's going to kind of flog, as it were. So no, it's great that there's not too much new, because with so many of these things, actually what people need is to kind of try and find their way through. I mean, we are still dealing with the outcome and the fallout from the pandemic, and anyone who thinks that, in a sense, that fallout is over really doesn't understand where some of the stuff around strikes and all the rest of it is coming from, and what's happening to workforce, you know, generally. So I think a bit of quiet would be really helpful. And I'd also say I'm absolutely certain, in terms of Debbie's point about, you know, oh, I've noticed that there'll be a bit of problem around admissions. Good luck with that. Well, that's kind of the point I meant about it being so late, because quite frankly, institutions have been well aware that it's probably still going to be a bit of, you know, turbulence in the system, and that it's not going to be easy. And actually, I think institutions did really rather well in how they managed last year from two previous years, where the changes that happened meant people couldn't plan at all. So I think the sector's kind of doing its best and probably knows what it's doing around admissions as much as possible.
Also absent from this is anything culture warsy, which is kind of a relief. It could have been so different if someone else had taken this job instead of Robert Halfen, couldn't it?
Yeah. Well, give it time.
Yes, yeah.
Well, and of course, what you say in a formal letter to vice chancellors might be rather different from what you say in the pages of the Telegraph, and that, you know, 'twas ever thus. But I mean, I don't think it would be the worst thing in the world for there to be a bit of work on degree apprenticeships. You know, you can imagine a sort of, you know, a constructive conversation, maybe a bit of a policy investigation, maybe some kind of tweaks to the system to make it easier for some universities to deliver them where there are barriers. I mean, that feels like it could be quite a useful chat.
But yeah,
maybe Andy, you sound more cynical than I do on this one.
Well, you're right, of course. But I mean, the first fundamental thing that Halfen knows is that apprenticeships really depend on employers stepping up and offering jobs. The training bit is secondary to that. So, you know, universities, yeah, absolutely have to play their part in expanding the offer, but it's contingent on other things. And by the way, you know, the same goes for T-levels. You know, they were designed for the workplace, not necessarily for entry to higher education. So, you know, a little bit of realism on both of those things would be welcome. But on degree apprenticeships, the you know, this is, as anyone, I mean, if universities don't offer them and are thinking of doing so, have a word with your local FE college and just, you know, find out how insanely bureaucratic they are. And how hard they are to deliver.
Returning to that kind of, you know, point again and again, and just, you know, because I think it's sort of clear that everyone likes the idea of apprenticeships. You know, it's just these that they're really, really difficult to deliver.
Yeah. And also the,
you know, and the incentive, you know, the incentives are not stacked up appropriately.
No, exactly. And where the incentives do exist, it's for piling through tons of MBAs and managers in existing firms and not 18-year-olds leaving school or college looking for a higher education place. So another level of honesty might be welcome there too.
Yeah. And, you know, just saying, having, you know, been in an institution that embraced degree apprenticeships because of our connections with businesses that wanted to give it a go. And of course the NHS is a major, the nurse associate thing is a major kind of degree apprenticeship type route as well. You know, we had to employ 4 additional people in order to deal with the Ofsted requirements. And that, if one's, thinking about efficiency, that's not terribly efficient, because those are people who are dealing with, they're not academics teaching. They're people dealing with the requirements of Ofsted. So they are in a completely different area. And actually, you know, it was entirely new for a university to be dealing with those kinds of things. So that's another aspect that perhaps one needs to think about.
Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
In my piece in Wonky this week, I discuss how, as a sector, we should not allow the current focus on evaluation to detract from the nuance and complexity of working in the widening access space. Since John Blake first shared his impact vision for the Office for Students, I've fully supported his calls for more robust and effective evaluation of widening access activities, and I still do. This is crucial. Without it, we run the risk of being a sector full of nice people doing well-intentioned things, with very little tangible evidence of what is really having the biggest impact. My concern is that, for some, the increased spotlight on evaluation might lead to a more risk-averse approach, prioritising those interventions which can be neatly boxed and evaluated, rather than those that might be truly transformative. All young people are complex, interesting, and diverse individuals, and interventions that work for one might well not work for another. A range of different approaches from different providers is required to create the right circumstances for success. Some work needs to be long-term and multifaceted, and not a short fix and simplistic. Working with over 40,000 students each year, our charity is one of the largest providers of access and participation work, and we've prioritised robust impact reporting and evaluation. Even so, because we work with young people from the age of 7 all the way until 18, and taking a variety of approaches to help them accomplish their ambitions, some interventions are not as easy to measure as others. But we strongly believe they all work together and would not be as effective if delivered in an isolated way, without our partners, or measured in a vacuum. I'm passionate about bringing about a real and lasting impact in widening access, and evaluation absolutely has a major role to play in how we ensure this happens.
Now, UCU have announced new strike dates, and we've got interesting data about casualisation in the HE workforce. Mary, can you walk us through it?
Okay, so I think probably most people in the sector will be aware that UCU has announced 18 days of strikes in February and March, starting on the 1st of February, which the TUC has called as a National Day of Action, because there are going to be lots of other unions going on strike on the 1st of Feb. Those 18 days are... not all the dates are announced yet, so watch the space. Wonky's always really good at telling us when things like that are happening, if you are not watching the UCU website the whole time, which I know that PVC's education are, and I know quite a number of them are feeling really worried about the number of strike days that are coming through. But in fact, this is the result of quite a bit of debate within UCU about what the right approach is. And it could have been, there could have been a lot more strikes than in fact they've announced. I think we ought to be aware of it. And it's part of something that Andy said earlier on, you know, same old things. It's part of the ongoing dispute over pay and pensions and concern over conditions. And I'll come to that in a sec. The conditions thing, I think, is a real issue, and we shouldn't just think it's about pay. Interestingly, for me, I think is actually the Public and Commercial Services Union is also going on strike. And of course, they are the union that deals with the departments, so BEIS and DfE, UKRI, OFS, Higher Education Funding Council for Wales, the Student Loan Company, Skills Development Scotland, and. Yeah. So it's not just UCU that will be going on strike, although UCU has the 18 days. But I was really interested in looking at the fact that the mandate for strike at the Office for Students was really high, as was in the Student Loan Company, as was in the DfE, as was in BEIS. In fact, BEIS was 90%. The Office for Students was 87%. So that's a strong mandate, and in fact, stronger than UCU. So it's very interesting to see that other parts of the sector, as it were, is also going to be affected by strikes. But I mean, you know, I think the major thing in terms of universities, and I do think this has got worse since the pandemic, is that the sense of community is really under threat in the sector. We've seen just in the last couple of days HESA data coming out, which has said that there's been a major increase, a kind of 20% plus increase in zero-hour contracts in the sector. Now, this is something the sector kind of promised that they'd start working on and reducing. I have to say, I think it must be because of partly of the turbulence that we've seen. They've needed to bring in people really quick in order to deal with new things that have emerged, additional students, and so on. But also, the sector's not really tackling underrepresentation of, for example, black staff in leadership positions. So really shocking that if you actually look at the number of black professors, it's only increased by 5 in the last year. And just quickly, some other research on kind of staffing issues in higher education. There's been a real jump in the number of staff who are saying that they will leave their roles in the next 24 months, from 3% to 6% saying they would leave. And okay, you know, we know that part of that is being driven by over 50s who are wanting a better work-life balance, but for the young members of staff in universities, the 19 to 26 year olds, they are at their highest ever for saying that they want to leave in the next 2 years. And I do think that there's a real challenge here about how people are feeling. You know, it's not just obviously in higher education. It's clearly really bad across the whole country, which is why we're having so many strikes. But it is an issue for the sector as well.
Andy, to what extent is this kind of main industrial action in the sector kind of particular to HE, or just part of this kind of wider industrial unrest that we have in this country for, you know, kind of macroeconomic reasons?
Yeah, well, it's both, isn't it? And I think the difficulty at the moment is like those other industrial disputes across the UK, it's just very hard to be optimistic here and increasingly difficult to see a way out of it. You know, there's no doubt working conditions are deteriorating, as you know, Mary points to the HESA data rightly. There's no doubt real terms pay's falling, and kind of inflation's obviously got a lot to do with that, but it's not just inflation. And the pension reforms, in my view, over the last few years have been handled really, really badly, and you know, need revisiting. Now, you know, of course, on the other side, you can see that, and we've already discussed it, universities are under huge financial pressure. Inflation is affecting them in exactly the same way. Increasing costs, frozen tuition fees for another 2 years. No signs of any increases on the horizon. You know, it's very difficult to see, as I say, a way out of this. And if you add to that the fact that all those places that universities have gone for kind of cross subsidy, whether it be international students, which are now being squeezed, or cross subsidy from within the institution, all of those are pretty much models that are at the end of the line. And if that's not enough, the government doesn't really care. And it's badly managing the sector. And that's part of it. That's reinforcing the problem in the same way that it is with the railways, the NHS, schools, and so on and so on.
There's also, I mean, there's interesting data, isn't there, about the public support for strikes. So, I mean, at the very top of the top of the tree is nurses, and then it's kind of, it goes down quite sharply after that, and university lecturers are somewhere around barristers with, you know, very, very small amounts of kind of wider public support. I've got a theory that despite that, universities are basically one of the bits of the economy that is actually working, basically. So, you know, you look around and, you know, trains are not running, whether or not there's industrial action. Obviously the NHS is in, you know, complete crisis. Universities are by and large getting on with it, and people aren't kind of particularly worried about them. And, you know, efforts to kind of drum up concerns about, you know, culture war issues and things like that aside, it isn't, you know, I don't think there's a kind of mass of people that seem to kind of worry about universities. And there's a good story to tell, isn't there, Debbie, about, you know, look, we're basically running our sector, you know, despite all of this, and it's sort of just about working. I mean, give or take.
Yeah, and I mean, I know I am. I can sometimes be a bit Pollyanna-ish about, you know, I'm sure the future will be better. But I do think there's something here that you know, when you look at universities' ability to cope, which is admirable, I think it's fair to say. But then when you triangulate that with the data on rise of 0 hours contracts, for example, I think what we're seeing, and I think that kind of public perception point is quite pertinent, because of course that's not what the public is seeing. You know, when they think of lecturers, they think of kind of, you know, well-heeled people in what they sort of imagine to be kind of comfortable offices and you know all the rest of it. So, you know, they're not thinking about kind of junior, you know, early career, casualised, very precarious staff. And of course, no vice chancellor will, you know, or, you know, university leader wants to kind of put people in a precarious job situation, but the level of structural change that would be required to kind of create the sorts of kind of staff communities that would be needed to kind of avoid that, I think just is too great in, you know, in this context. So I think, you know, and I think there's a real question here about how universities communicate their situation. Because obviously for the best part of the last decade, universities have sort of tried to insist that they're not awash with cash. I think perhaps the real kind of human cost of universities not only not being awash with cash, but genuinely struggling. And I think it's very hard for university to say we are not coping. But the kind of the consequence of that is that there is an impact on staff and how you square that circle. You know, and so yeah, it is really, really challenging.
Yeah, it's definitely worse than you think.
Yeah,
I say that from inside. But it's,
yeah, I think,
you know,
I think it is, and I also think that, you know, when we talk about universities, it's really important that we actually talk about the fact that these are communities. And why I keep going on about that is that, you know, you have HR professionals, you have finance, you have accountants, you have technicians, you have cleaning staff and porterers. And, you know, so when you're talking about universities, you're talking about the full range of people in society. You know, and I think that that is often not understood. And you know, they are, they're large organizations, and they are the size of you know, towns often in that context. And helping those people to get along and to rub along well is really, really crucial. And they are experiencing the same challenges that anyone else in our society is experiencing. And we need to be telling that story more. You know, they are your neighbors, whoever you are.
Well, I mean, Mary, I'm really curious, because when you think about it, and it's noticeable, we've had a few vice-chancellor resignations lately, and I don't know if that's kind of a straws in the wind thing, or if, you know, if there's a sort of Jacinta Ardern, you know, people are very tired, and actually we're going to see quite a lot, you know, a bit more exiting from the sector at the kind of senior level. But, you know, you work with aspiring emerging leaders. When they look at that question of kind of how, as a leader, can I foster the sense of community? How can I essentially handle some of these really serious systemic problems that the sector is facing? You know, do they feel optimistic? Do they feel capable? Or do they, you know, are they sort of prepared to, you know, come up with fresh ways of achieving this community that we feel feels like so kind of precarious right now?
I mean, you know, I have to say this is one of the greatest privileges of my life, to be working with the next generation of potential leaders in higher education. And it is something I really wanted to do, because I think these people are enormously important, because they face both ways. They look after their community of subject experts or of professional service experts, and they also are excellent in communicating with senior leaders, and so they face both ways, and I think in many ways it's one of the most challenging roles that you can have. And it's not the same as being a middle manager in another industry, because higher education is all about debate, discussion, the why. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you are a line manager. Actually, people in higher education need to engage in discussion before they'll be happy to move forward with one thing or another thing. So it's a really pivotal role. I've been hugely impressed with the level of determination and commitment that I see. I don't see simple bubbly optimism. I do see determination to make things work. And so many of these people saying, I've come into this role because I want to make sure that people, you know, people are looked after. I want to look after my discipline. I want to see my students thrive. So, you know, it's not altruistic. They're paid, of course, but, you know, the commitment is phenomenal. And yeah, I'm blown away with that, actually.
It's really fascinating. And what about this question about vice chancellors? Is there a pattern here?
Well, you know, I think you go through peaks and troughs of resignations of vice chancellors. And of course, you know, you work up through your career, and it takes a certain amount of time. So by the time you become a vice chancellor, you know, you're unlikely to be that young, if I can just put it that way. And so it is quite generational. And this is, for me, you know, being close to it, the kind of third wave of which I consider myself to be part of that third wave. And I don't know if it's a Japanese wave that we're kind of going to get tsunamied, washed away sort of thing. But I do see this happening in waves. So, yes, there are quite a lot happening now. Is that directly related to the pandemic? Well, the pandemic won't have helped, let's put it that way. You know, if just speaking personally, I had already handed in my notice to my chair before the pandemic struck, and she said, oh, just give me a little while to get my, you know, ducks in a row before we announce. But that when we were going to announce was the week after the first lockdown. So I just said, look, we can't do this. And I stayed for a further 2 years. So in all, I did 12 years as vice-chancellor, which I really do think is long enough for any organization to put up with a vice-chancellor, actually. But I think that it will have contributed because it wasn't great, quite frankly. You know, you would walk around the campus, it was like tumbleweed. It was horrible. And, you know, you're constantly worried about your poor students who, in certainly in our case, all came back to stay in res. They did not just go home. They came back having gone home because they felt they couldn't study at home. So, you know, what can we do when they're stuck in their residences to make life a bit better? So it wasn't great, I don't think, for anyone. But I think it's also generational, Mark, actually.
I think, you know, if you're sort of, let's say, well established as a vice chancellor, you've been in the role for sort of, you know, a few years, and you kind of, you know, you look at the horizon, you look at the next 3 years, it does look pretty grim. So if you've gone into Christmas after a very tough COVID kind of period, so certainly for anybody in office during that time, you kind of think, well, okay, maybe I'd have lasted a little bit longer under different circumstances, but as I say, look ahead for the next kind of 2 or 3 years, and you just think this is going to get tougher and tougher.
No, I completely agree with you, Andy. I think you know, the situation in terms of, because, you know, I feel that demands for higher pay are entirely legitimate in the kind of, you know, situation the country is in, and people seeing their lifestyles being really eaten into, and people being worried about mortgages and, you know, all that kind of thing. So I completely understand it. But actually, I don't think universities have that much freedom to be able to do too much about that, because actually I think, well, some institutions could dig into reserves, could do that kind of thing, but actually a lot of institutions aren't in that place.
Now it's time for Play Your Data Right. Here to set this week's statistical conundrum, it's Wonky's associate editor David Kernahan.
Welcome to Play Your Data Right, the podcast segment that works exactly the same way as an 80s game show you may have seen, apart from instead of using playing cards, we use Leo data. This time, I'm looking at median salary data 5 years after graduation for male and female graduates, and this is a multi-year average this time. The first combination of provider and subject area is engineering at York. The median salary there is £35,900. Is the median salary for computing at Oxford Brookes higher or lower?
That's a tough one. As with everything on Leo, I always think about geography, even though kind of nobody else does. But I'm going to go engineering at York.
The answer is higher. The median salary for computing at Oxford Brookes 5 years after graduation for male and female graduates is £42,300. That's substantially higher than engineering at York, which was £35,900. How did you get on at home?
Hi, it's Jim from the team here with news of The Secret Life of Students. Back for its fourth year, we're going to take the opportunity to get real about students, bringing together sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and students' union managers, to get an accurate and unvarnished picture of the student condition in 2023, so we can work out how to respond rather than just react. Shifting from a surface-level understanding of student satisfaction with services to a deeper understanding of their motivations, ambitions and lives can be hugely rewarding and important both for them and those supporting them. It's also vital in an age that seems quick to assume, judge and condemn students rather than listen, understand and act on their concerns. So at the event, we'll be asking questions like, what are students doing when they're not in the classroom? Where is the line between their desire to collaborate and regulations that ban collusion? Is it true they're not prepared to debate and discuss controversial issues? Why do they rate assessment and feedback so badly on the NSS? And how many are confident about being real students, let alone what comes next? On the day, we'll feature key findings into the student experience from the past year, we'll launch exciting new research into the student learning experience beyond the classroom, and we'll launch our new student insights platform, Belong, a Wonky Group GTI initiative, and we'll share the first findings from its research. It's an essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the Secret Life of Students, London, March the 14th. We'd love to see you there. Go to wonky.com/events and book now.
The heads of the mission groups are calling for an inquiry into the Office of Students. Andy, walk us through that.
Okay, so I think this is quite interesting. I mean, in line with lots of the things we've discussed so far about bits of the sector, whether it be funding or industrial relations being broken, here's a kind of third leg to that stool. The Russell Group, University Alliance, Million Plus and Guild HE have written to the chair of the Education Select Committee, Robin Walker, saying there should be an inquiry into the Office for Students. And I think by extension, the whole regulatory approach to HE in England. And basically they're saying it's not really fit for purpose. The killer line in the letter, such an inquiry could assess whether it has succeeded and whether it has the confidence of the sector in the way it carries out its regulatory duties. Now, if you look at the way the mission groups work in higher education, of course, they are the voices of the vice chancellors as their individual members. And basically what this is saying is that OFS isn't working in their view. It doesn't have their confidence and they don't think it succeeded. So, just as we've already described the kind of broken nature of funding in higher education and the kind of rather lamentable state of industrial relations, here's another one to chuck in that direction. We've got a regulatory system that isn't fit for purpose either, and no university appears to think that it is. So another problem to add to our lengthening list, and maybe another reason why lots of vice chancellors and others are saying I can't be done with this.
So, I mean, we've talked about this a bit on the podcast before, well, quite a lot actually. Mary, do you think it's a kind of reasonable charge?
I think it's reasonable to request a review of the Office for Students, not least because any good practice would say, well, okay, it's been operating for, for going on 5 years now. Let's take a look. And that would be good practice, actually. So I think even at that level, it would be worth doing. Is regulation working? Well, it is in bits, but it's in bits as well. If I can put it that way, I do think it. And I think the level of distrust between the Office of Students on the one hand and institutions on the other is really not helpful at all. And I don't really see, I know they've got a student panel, but I don't really see where the student voice really is. And it's a complete misnomer, actually.
Yeah, I mean, two quick things I'd add, really. One is this mirrors quite nicely the OFS's kind of opening sort of communication to universities back in the days of its formation, where it said, we're not going to be your friend like EFKI. And a few years down the track, here are the universities saying, well, we're not your friends either.
They weren't lying about that though, were they?
No, they weren't lying. And so it's quite neat in that respect. But I think the other thing to say is that, I think the OFS has it was always a tricky job. And there's a lot of people that work with the OFS that work for the OFS or have worked for the OFS that I've got a lot of time for. But the problem is the model has always been too narrow. It's never really been the right model for running higher education in England. And really kind of, it's always struggled with that. And I think the reality is that it's days are numbered really on that basis. It was arguably never fit for the purpose that it was set out for. And we're just coming to the kind of point where something's going to have to come along and replace it.
So, Andy, do you think that this letter from the different mission groups is actually as much a statement to, you know, people thinking about higher education in any manifestos and thinking about that kind of thing? Do you think it's as much about thinking about the future as it is expecting to get a review now?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's a marker in the ground saying kind of, you know, we've got to think beyond this. So, you know, a review is a quite polite way of saying that. But as I say, between the lines, it's not that polite at all.
It's interesting then, isn't it, that Universities UK isn't a signatory? Because actually, that sort of blurring between representative body and mission group, and Gilditchy, of course, is technically a representative body, but it's kind of aligning itself with mission groups for these purposes. I find it very hard to believe that there hasn't been some quite detailed conversation behind the scenes that sort of says, look, we're going out like this, you know, and Viv at UUK will have had to sort of think quite carefully about where UUK positions itself in relation to, you know, does it come out against the regulator essentially, or does it kind of keep its powder dry, perhaps with a view to kind of trying to kind of move things forward in a more moderate way. And it will almost certainly be absolutely strategic rather as opposed to, you know, that the mission group sort of went off and did their thing. I think whether or not there is an inquiry, I suspect that this will unfold further.
It's tricky for Universities UK, as lots of things are, but let's not kind of forget that kind of most of the members of the mission groups are also most of the members of Universities UK. So I don't think we should get I don't think we should get too wrapped up in them not being there. You know, the members' voice about how they're being regulated on a day-to-day basis is clear, and they're not happy with it. And so but I think, Mary, you're absolutely right. I think this is a kind of marker for the future, and I think kind of what lots of institutions are saying here, and this is my interpretation, is that going forward, we need to look at this. It hasn't really worked as an approach to the sector because so much is kind of sidelined in it, and we need to think rather more holistically about the role of universities, what students want from them, and many other things besides.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Andy, Mary, Debbie, and our news editor, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. See you then.